All right. You see the screen properly? Very good. Baruch Hashem. Okay, let's go. Let's start. Today we're going to learn at least some ideas, some parts of a talk of the Rebbe. The Rebbe was Rabbi Schneur, I'm sorry, Menachem Mendel Schneerson, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. He shared these ideas in 1964. We're going to analyze a specific prayer of the Jewish people by lighting the Hanukkah candles. I assume most of you, or at least all of you, I don't know what Hanukkah is all about. We're not going to learn the details, the exact details of what Hanukkah is. Actually, you can find this so easy anywhere in Google, whatever. Just Google up what's Hanukkah and you'll see. We're not going to go into the details of the story, etc. I assume you know this. We're going to analyze one of the prayers that our sages told us to actually sing. Everybody sings it with different melodies, etc. And we're going to see that something is like weird, strange into this prayer. And by analyzing it, by understanding it, we're going to have a hopefully a deeper understanding of what means, not necessarily Hanukkah, but really what means the way God manages his world. What do we see out of him, and what can we actually accomplish by in ourselves by seeing this? So let's start. First of all, the prayer itself. We actually pronounce these words with a in Chabad, in specifically speaking, we sing it with a long song. It's a nice, very nice song. There are other melodies also, but basically these are the words that we say. We light the candles. We say the proper blessings for lighting the candles every day, etc. Each day we light a different amount of candles, as it's known, and then we sing this. Every day we sing this. We sing the same thing. What's the text? The text is: we kindle these lights. So we kindle these lights. Imagine you have the menorah in front of you. Maybe it's proper to say that menorah can effectively light a menorah. You should not say the prayers because I'm sorry, the blessings. Because the blessings doesn't make sense. It says that God commanded us to do such and such thing, and the truth is that God did not command Bnei Noach to do such and such thing, which does not mean that they cannot do it. They can do it. They can remember Hanukkah. They can think about the messages of Hanukkah. Everything is okay, and we're going to talk about this also later. But the blessings themselves don't make any sense. That's why I didn't even mention it in this particular presentation. But this is the prayer we actually say after lighting the candles. We kindle these lights to commemorate, to remember, whatever, the salvations, miracles, and wonders. Pay attention that I actually underlined, so to speak, these words, which you have performed for us, for our forefathers in those days, at this time, through your holy priests, whatever the story of Hanukkah is. Throughout the 8 days of Hanukkah, these lights are sacred, we are not permitted to make use of them, but only to look at them, in order to offer thanks and praise to your great name, for your miracles, for your wonders and salvations. This is what we say, and we sing it. It's very nice. Okay, so let's analyze a little bit better why I underlined these particular words. If you pay attention, I added the transliteration, the Hebrew, for those who know Hebrew, and the English parts. So I'm trying to be as clear as possible. At the beginning of the song, I'll go back it in a minute, so you will see it in the whole text itself. It didn't fit in just one screen. So in the beginning of the song, we use this particular order. First of all, we talk about salvations, then we talk about miracles, and then we talk about wonders. Let's go back a little bit. You see, we kindle these lights, commemorate, etc. Salvations, miracles, or wonders which you have made. Ta ta ta. Very nice. In Hebrew, you say tshuos. Teshua means the salvation. Nisim, nes, in singular means a miracle. Nisim means miracles, many. And niflois means like wonders. Wow, things that we say, interesting, wonders. However, at the end of the song, we change the order. And it's strange. Why? Our sages are so precise. First we say miracles, then we say wonders, and then salvations. Look at the whole text, and you'll see exactly the same thing. Only we look at the Hanukkah candles in order to offer thanks and praise to your great name for your miracles, wonders, and salvations. So again, wait a second, something is going on here. First we say salvations, miracles, and wonders, and then we say miracles, wonders, and salvations. What's going on? Why? In order to understand why, first of all, we have to understand what's exactly each one of these three things. What's a salvation, what's a miracle, and what's a wonder? I put a dictionary over here, but the truth is that I did not look at the dictionary. Not this time. I do it usually, but this time I didn't do it. The point over here is the Rebbe offers us an explanation based on the story with examples of the story itself. And then we're going to see this in the story of Hanukkah itself, and we hopefully will understand. And then after understanding the change in the order, we'll go a little bit deeper. So first of all, a salvation. What's a salvation? A salvation, the Rebbe explains like this. When you're at war with your enemy, imagine Hanukkah is started as a war, actually. We'll see this in a minute. When you're at war and your enemy's strength actually is basically the same one as you, you can compare yourself to your enemy in quality, in quantity. You can imagine that today, in those days, they didn't have so many different types of arms, but today it's so many different kinds of arms. So you can compare yourself to your enemy. Basically, same amount of soldiers. That's just an example. And basically, same type of weapons. So when you win the war, actually, what does it mean? It means, look, we actually made an effort and we won the war. It could have happened that they, the enemy, won the war. Yes, it could have been, God forbid, but we won. That looks basically like a natural thing. It could have been, again, it could have been the other way, that they won the war, but we did. We made more effort, whatever the case is, we won the war. That's a salvation. It's, again, something that remains in the ways of nature. It's a natural thing. It looks like a natural thing. What about God? I don't know. Not necessarily God helped on this one, so to speak. Of course, God makes everything. He's the creator. That's fine. We know that, so to speak. Hopefully, we know that. The point over here is that a salvation means a way of winning something, in this case, a war, but doesn't really look like a supernatural thing. Not at all. Then we go to the second part, miracles. What's a miracle? A miracle is something that is way beyond nature, completely beyond any explanation you can make. Nothing you can say about this makes sense. It's something that, according to the ways of nature, it should not have happened at all. In the example that we're going to give about the war, etc., etc., of Hanukkah, the weaker in quality and the lesser in quantity, actually, they end up winning. It's something not natural, not normal, so to speak. We call this a miracle. To be honest, and this is like touching into something we're going to learn later, the whole world is a miracle, actually. Everything that you see around you is actually a miracle. The sun coming out and the moon and the stars and whatever, everything is a miracle. Why? Why don't we look at it as a miracle? Because we're used to it. It seems like nature, quote unquote, is like a natural thing. It's like something that happens one time and another time and another time. Every time is the same. So we say this is normal. But the truth is, it's not normal. And I'll explain this later, hopefully. But that's basically what we need to know. What's the difference between a salvation and a miracle? A salvation is something that a person might say, I did not need God for this one. It was enough with my own strength. Miracle means this is impossible. God is the only one that can do such a thing. It defies the order of nature. And what's a wonder? If you know how to read, you already got it, I hope. It's not really something that you say, wow, this is a miracle. It's impossible to happen. No, it could happen. It could happen, but it's really weird. It's really strange. When you see this, you say, wow, this is a wonder. This is something wondrous. Like, I didn't think this would happen. It could, but I didn't think, like, in probabilities, you know, in statistics, whatever. It's a very, very low number of probabilities. But still a probability, still something probable, still something that can happen. That's a wonder. So it's three types of ideas. Again, going back a little bit on purpose, in the prayer we say after lighting the Hanukkah candles, we say salvations, miracles, and wonders. God did for us in the story of Hanukkah, as we're going to see in a minute, these three types of things. But again, the question is, why do we mention actually these three types of things in a different order? First we say salvation, miracles, and wonders, and then we say miracles, wonders, and salvation. Why? So let's go. First of all, the prayer starts talking about the story in itself. I just copied a little piece of the prayer itself. You have, God, of course, you have performed for our fathers in those days. We just remember how the story went on. How did it start? Our sages, there are quite a few ways of seeing this, of learning this, but at least this is the simplest one. How did it start? There was a town called Moedim. Actually, there's a city in Eretz Israel, in the land of Israel, that is called Moedim. I don't know if it's exactly the same one or not. I have no idea. It doesn't really matter. The point is, there was a place called Moedim. In this place, there was a family that lived. The family of Hashmoinaim, which was a family of priests, Koyanim. And this family had all kinds of people. The highest priest, the Koyan Godol, was actually part of this family in that particular time. And there were a group of warriors, so to speak, that belonged to this family. And the story, as it's brought down, the Greeks were in this town. They had soldiers spread out the whole land of Israel. In this particular place, there was a group of soldiers. And this group of soldiers wanted to actually demoralize, bother really, and bring down the spirit of the Jews. And they started offering a pig to their gods, whatever. So the Jews were really angry at this one. And this family of Hashmoinaim saw this whole thing going on. And they said, that's it, enough for us. And they started rebelling against the Greeks. In the very small place, very small amount of people, on both sides, on the Jew side and then on the Greek side. And they won. And they won. What is that? That's a salvation. Why? Because there were many probabilities that the Greeks would win or the Jews would win. Again, small amount of people, very restricted problem, so to speak, just one place, one town, small. But the Greeks were very angry at this when they saw that the Jews started rebelling. And Antioch, whatever you say it in English or in Hebrew, Antiochus, he decided to send a whole army and actually destroy the whole thing, destroyed the whole land of Israel. It's interesting to mention, even though it's not really what we're learning right now, but it's a subject in itself. Hanukkah, it's a very special holiday for the Jewish people. In Hanukkah, we don't really celebrate that the Jewish people got saved from an enemy or whatever the case, like Purim. Purim, we got saved from Haman and Ahasuerus, etc. Complete annihilation, whatever. No, Hanukkah is different. Why? Because the way the Greeks actually conquered the different lands they conquered, they wanted to bring their civilization into the places where they conquered. They were not so interested in killing people. Like in war, at war you have to kill people, okay? But that was not the main point of the Greeks. The main point of the Greeks was, we want to enlighten, quote unquote, everybody. So we're going to bring our civilization, our enlightenment, quote unquote, in every single place where we go. So in Hanukkah, we celebrate, actually, that we did not get enlightened, quote unquote, by the Greeks. We actually won, so to speak, in this case, the war against their civilization, so to speak. Basically, it's a whole thing in Halacha, in Jewish law, and it's a whole thing on how we actually celebrate Hanukkah. But in Purim, we celebrate by eating. In Hanukkah, we celebrate by lighting candles. Why? Like, why don't we just eat a lot? In every single Jewish holiday we eat and we eat and we eat. Why don't we do that in Hanukkah? Because Hanukkah is, again, it's about the essence of Judaism and the connection to God. That's what the Greeks were against. Of course, just in case, has nothing to do with the Greeks right now. Greece is okay and no problem with them. We're talking about thousands of years ago. Okay, Having said that, Antiochus got very angry at the Jewish people, and he decided to send an army to actually conquer the place. Again, not necessarily to kill everybody. That wasn't his main point. His main point was to civilize, enlighten, whatever, the Jewish people. But if you need to conquer the place, so you're going to have to make war, wage war, whatever. So he sent a terrible army with elephants, the whole story about it. And the point is that God delivered. This is part of the prayers that we say actually every day, three times a day in Judaism. Deliver the mighty into the hands of the weak. Of course, the mighty were the Greek army. The weak were the Jewish people. Many into the few. So you see again, quality and quantity. We actually won. It wasn't something normal. It wasn't something you can call a salvation. It was impossible. So many people, so prepared, again, in quality. They were warriors, and the Jewish people were never warriors, actually. So, even so, we won. So that's called a miracle. Something, it was not normal that it should happen. Then, the story of Hanukkah goes around that the Jewish people recovered the control of the temple in Jerusalem, in Yerushalayim, and the Greeks actually profaned the whole temple. They got dirty the whole place. They impurified the whole place, including one specific place that was called the Chamber of Oils. They used to store oil over there. You can imagine, going back to what I explained before, the way the Greeks actually would conquer a place. What does it mean to impurify oil according to the Jewish law? Not according to the Greek law. I don't know the Greek law in ancient times. I have no idea. But what about the Jewish law? If a non-Jew touches the oil, or even moves the jug where the oil is, the oil gets impure. Now, what did the Greeks do? They did not destroy the place, the temple itself, even the chamber of oils. They did not spill out and spread out everything. No, they opened jug by jug. Can you imagine that? You enter a place, you just conquer the place, and basically you just, whatever, destroy everything, take everything for you. No. Leave it where it is. Just open each jug and put your finger inside and then close it again. That's all they did. So all the oils in this chamber, so to speak, were impure. And when this family of Koyanim, of priests, Hashmoinaim, they recovered the temple, etc., with the help of many other people, of course, they wanted to actually restart the whole service in the temple, which is actually why Hanukkah is called Hanukkah. That's what it means. Hanukkah comes from the word chinuch. Chinuch means reinaugurate, like restart, reopen. They wanted to reopen the service in the temple, and they wanted to relight the menorah. The menorah is actually seven candles, not eight or nine, as you see in Hanukkah. It's a different story, and I'm not going to explain the details right now. But the point is, they wanted to actually restart the whole service. Part of the service was to light a menorah, a candelabra with seven candles. But they didn't have oil. And to produce new oil, they had to actually go to a different place in the land of Israel. It was called Tekoya, that's what it was called. Produce the oil and bring it back. It was a whole process of 8 days. Just to go over there, produce the oil, bring it back, etc. There was no time for that. We wanted to start today. Like, start everything to run again. So they decided that they have to actually look, and they wanted to do it in the best way possible, which, between parentheses, is one of the main teachings of Hanukkah that applies to every single human being. When you're doing something, do your real, real best. Do your best, not just, so-so. No. Do your best. The halacha, the law is that the Koyanim could, at that time, light the menorah with impure oil. It was okay. I mean, really, it was okay. By the Jewish law, it was okay. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to do it the best way, with pure oil. But there was no oil. So they started looking around all the place, and they found just one jug of oil. And the truth is that this jug of oil was like buried into the ground. That's how they knew that the Greeks did not touch it. And it was sealed with the seal of the high priest. That's how they knew that they didn't open it and put their finger inside. So they didn't touch it. They didn't touch it inside, I mean. But that's why this is pure. So they took this jug, but the problem is every single day the menorah used one jug of oil. So for the next day they needed more oil and so on. Okay, there was a miracle, very nice. But the point is, what's the wonder behind all of this? Again, we define wonder as something that could happen. It's not impossible, but it's really, as the word actually reads, it's a wonder. Wow, interesting. Look. So the wonder over here is that they found this jug of oil. That's not necessarily a miracle. The miracle is that it led 8 days when it actually had the amount of oil for just one day. That's a miracle. That's a different story. But the wonder over here is that they found this thing. It wasn't impossible. No, the truth is it's not impossible. Like when you just miss something and you start looking around, it's probable that you're going to find it. Specifically speaking, if you know that there's a chamber of oils, where is the oil in this particular chamber? So just look around. Maybe you'll find something. And they found it. It's a wonder. It's not necessarily a miracle. Of course, it's not a salvation. It's a wonder. Something that, again, arouses, awakens, like, whoa, look, we found it. This is the way the story actually happened. But going back a little bit, just a second, again, this is the way the prayer, so to speak, starts. Salvations, miracles, and wonders. But the way and this is the way the story goes. Actually, that's what happened. First, the salvation in war, then miracles in war, and then the wonder of finding a jug of oil. However, at the end of the prayer, we say in a different order, miracles, wonders, and salvations. Why? Okay, so let's go. Next one. How do you actually thank God? What's the feeling you get in your heart by being thankful to the Lord or whatever you call it, God, according to what happens in your life? For which things is your thankfulness deeper and stronger for what happens in your life? The truth is that when a person sees a miracle, everybody recognizes, wow, this comes from God. It's impossible. It's impossible to happen. So the easiest, so to speak, the easiest way that a person can actually be thankful in his life to God is when he sees a miracle. He, she, of course, is the same thing. When you see a miracle, you clearly say, wow, this is a godly thing. It's impossible. That's the definition of a miracle. We'll see in a minute that there are different types of miracles. But for now, that's the way we thank God in the deepest way. Wow, a miracle. However, if you really start thinking about it and you really start contemplating, you realize that even, not just the miracles come from God, even the wonders of life also come from God. Again, what were wonders? Wonders were things that could happen, but it's really not probable. Very, very low amount of probability that this might actually happen. So you actually, again, you need contemplation in meditation. In Hebrew, you say, it's bonenut. You start thinking about it, really. And afterwards, you realize this is a godly thing. And the lesser thing, really the lesser thing you thank God for, is what people would actually say, it's a salvation. Why? Because the probability that it might happen is so high that not necessarily you see God involved in this. In the miracles, you see God clearly involved. It's impossible without God. In the wonders, you say, okay, let me think about it. And then you realize that this comes from God. But in salvations, you really need a deeper contemplation to actually recognize that this is not a natural thing. This also comes from God, even though it might seem a natural thing. Even nature, as we see it, is really not nature, as we're going to learn in a minute. So going back, just to answer, so to speak, to finish this particular part of the explanation, in the prayer, why do we say salvations, miracles, and wonders first? Because that's the way the story happened, actually. To be honest, and actually the Rebbe mentions this, is interesting, just in brackets. After the wonders, there was another miracle. What's the miracle? The idea that the oil lasted, etc., etc. Oh, that's impossible. It's a miracle. But for some reason, our sages did not mention this in the prayer. Maybe they just included it in the miracles, in the word miracles. That's why it's in plural. Why salvations is in plural? Because also, the way the the Hashmonaim, this family of Koyanim, of priests, waged war against the Greeks, was like a guerrilla, something like they just attacked a little bit and they went back to the mountains, and they went down and attacked a little bit and they went back to the mountains. So it was a whole bunch of salvations, not just one. It started with one salvation, but then there were many, many other salvations. Then miracles and the wonders. But in the feeling of a person, again, to offer thanks and praise to God, how do you actually, for which things you easily, quickly offer praise and thanks to God? When you see a miracle. Again, something that defies nature. For wonders, you need a little bit more of thinking to offer praise to God. And the last thing you actually offer praise to God is for salvations. But the truth is that also salvations come from God. And that's what we're going to learn right now, which is a little bit, next one, a little bit deeper. Let's go a little bit deep into all of this. I, on purpose, did not write so many Hebrew words all around because I thought it would be like difficult to concentrate and to go into what they mean. So I'll try to explain this with as less amount of Hebrew words as possible. But when you start digging deeper, you like end up learning and having to deal with the Hebrew. I'm not saying you have to go learn Hebrew. That's not the message. The message is the deeper you want to go and the clearer and deeper you want to understand Torah, you have to know at least a few words, at least a few things. Just in these days, I had an argument. There's a YouTube channel, whatever. I'm in the English YouTube channel. I have a Spanish one, an English one. There's somebody constantly arguing, telling me that there's more than one God. There are actually two gods, and he brings proofs. I don't even know what it is, what this person is, whatever. Brings proofs from different verses in the Torah. There are more than one God, just two, actually two. First question is, do you know the Hebrew? Like, do you understand the Hebrew text? The answer, of course, is no. You just got the English text. And based on the English text, which is already an interpretation of the Hebrew text, which actually, to be honest, the English one is an interpretation of the Greek one. And the Greek one is an interpretation of the Hebrew one. So it's all interpretation after interpretation comes to the conclusion that there is more than one God. So the truth is, to understand Torah clearly and deeply, you have to go to the source, so to speak. And this actually happens in many ways of life, in many things in life, not just Torah. If you really want to know medicine, so you have to go deep into the books. Yeah, I heard once a YouTube streamer that talked about medicine. You think you're a doctor already? Come on, people learned for 10 years or more than that, the whole life, just to be a doctor. And you think because you saw one video on YouTube, you became a doctor. I think there's more to medicine than just one video on YouTube. Whatever the case. So let's go a little bit deeper. What's nature? We're used to see things happening in life. And since we're so used to that, we call this nature. We call these normal things that happened because the sun comes out and the moon and the stars and so on. That's a normal thing. That's what we call nature. However, even nature, the truth is that it's not really something obvious. And that's, it's not really something that happens without intervention of God. Even nature transcends nature. What does that mean? What's the phrase, the point? The point of the phrase is, every single thing in the world is constantly created by God. Second by second, nanosecond by nanosecond. How do I know this? Very simple. We say the creation is something from nothing. And to be honest, even though I'm not doing this at all, I'm not going to do that, but you could find this whole thing in science also. Something from nothing. They think about it, even the Big Bang, like where the particles are destroyed, whatever, got together and created the whole world. Where did they come from? The answer, nothingness. We don't know. Nothingness. Okay. So it's not a crazy religious thing to think about something from nothing. We say that the whole world is created something from nothing. Why? Why do we say this? Very simple. Very simple. The world to exist needs the intervention of God. Why? Because God creates the world That's how the Torah actually expresses it, the scriptures express it, in a way of words. The verses say God spoke and he created this one, this thing. God spoke and he created this something, other thing, whatever. Why does the Torah use the word speaking, speech? Why is God creating with speech? Because the Torah wants to explain how the creation works. Just as when we talk, our voice is heard, and if I stop talking, that's it, no more words. In the same way, the whole creation is, quote unquote, the speech of God, God talking. But that doesn't mean, and I'll bring an example in a second, it's a very simple example brought down in Hasidic thought, just the same exact thing happens in the whole creation. The creation is something being done constantly. And as soon as God stops acting, doing the creation ceases to exist, stops existing. The example brought in Hasidus is very simple. In Hasidic thought, it's like this. When you throw a stone, so you have to, of course, if you know a little bit of physics, there's a strength, there's a force applied on the stone, that this force is higher than the force of gravity of the earth, and then the stone starts like flying. You throw the stone, and the stone starts flying. When the force actually consumes, because you have a limited amount of force, of course, even if you're very strong, you can just throw the stone so far, whatever it is, the stone just falls. Okay, imagine you take a picture of the flying stone. You took the picture, and you see, look, you see? The stone is flying. Now the question is this a flying stone? Like the stone in itself became a stone that flies? The answer is no. The stone is flying because there's a force applied to the stone, and when the force ends up, etc., etc., the stone falls. The stone itself, like in essence, the stone is not a flying object. No, it happens to be flying. Yeah, you're right. It's flying right now until some point in time. It's flying. That's fine. It's true. But that doesn't mean that it's an object that could fly by itself. It did not acquire the quality of flying. Why is this example interesting? Because exactly the same thing happens to the world. We open our eyes, we see around, and we see the world exists. Does it mean that the world in itself acquired the quality of existence? No. Why is the world existing? Because there's a quote-unquote force applied on the world, on everything, on myself, on the computer, on the book, on everything around us. There's a force, creative force of God applied to every single millimeter, whatever, of the world, making it exist. That's why it exists. But if the force would not be applied just for a nanosecond, the world would cease to exist, as if it never existed. And God is recreating the whole thing every single time, and not just like saying, okay, he creates the book. No, he's creating me. Okay, well, who am I? I'm just a person with a story, of course. I'm 50 years old, and I have my family, and I have this, the blah, blah, blah. All my memories, all the things that I do not remember, etc., etc. God is creating that constantly. And then I'm just one guy. Then there's billions of guys, of people around the world, and God is creating every single thing, every single cell of all of these people, every single memory, every single neuron, whatever. Everything, and that's just human beings. Okay, now let's go to animals. There are animals that are going around. He's creating your dog and his dog and his cat and his every single thing, and the memories of the dog, because the dogs also have memories. Everything, second by second. It's like crazy thinking. But this is what it's called, at least in Chabad Hasidus, hisboinenus, meditation. That's what it means. Just close your eyes and think. Take one animal. One dog, okay. How many hairs does the dog have? How many, the ears of the dog? You see, the dog moves the muscles of the dog. And this is just one animal. And you can think for hours, all the cells and all the things and the stomach and the blah, blah, blah. All of this is created by God, second by second, nanosecond by nanosecond. That's what actually is called nature. But nature in itself hides, this is the essence of the word nature in Hebrew, which is called Teva. I forgot to write it down in the presentation. Teva, T-E-V-A, Teva. Teva means nature in Hebrew. But it's directly related to the word Tuvu. Tuvu Bayam is it's hidden inside, sunken inside something. The nature hides God behind it. That's what nature actually is. It's a godly force that has the quality of hiding God, hiding himself. Why is he hiding? Why doesn't he show himself? Okay, that's Moshiach. That's what it means, Moshiach. We're going to see God, and it's not my invention. This is what the texts actually say, that all the eyes in Isaiah, in Isaiah, whatever, all the eyes will see God, etc., etc. He's not going to hide himself anymore. Your master is not going to hide himself anymore, etc., etc. Many, many verses talking about this revelation of God. Okay, that's Moshiach. But right now, he's hidden. Why does he hide? Because he wants to give us room to choose between doing good or not. That's our part, so to speak, in creation. If he would be revealed, we would see how he is giving us life, and nobody would be so stupid to rebel against him. Like, you're rebelling against your own source of life. You're dead. So that's why he hides himself, which is a different philosophical idea, concepts, etc., etc. But the point is that, again, nature itself is not really what we call nature. Like, yeah, something that happens just because it happens. No. There's a godly force behind it, making it happen all the time. Just that sometimes you see miracles. What's a miracle? A miracle is a window that opens itself to actually God. Now you're seeing God. What does that mean? That you see an old guy with a white beard? No. No, forget it. That's what Daniel saw. It was just a seeing, that's whatever. No, that's not God. God doesn't have a body, doesn't have a beard, nothing of that. However, when you see a miracle, you start seeing the infinite force behind nature. That which actually covers God, for some reason, because God decided, became uncovered. Now there's a window into infinity, so to speak. That's what it means, a miracle. That's what it means, a miracle. And to be honest, again, everything is a miracle. Some things you see them as a miracle, and some things you don't, but it doesn't stop being a miracle. And this helps us understand a little bit. There's a phrase, a famous phrase. It's in the, actually in here, believes in the eternal life and plants. There's a plant. Hi, where's my mouse? My mouse just left. Okay, here it is. Over here. It's just an expression. It's found over here. It comes from a different Talmud Yerushalmi, whatever. The point is, that why does a person actually, what would be the real feeling of a person that has a field and seeds, plants seeds on the field? Usually people think, okay, there's the earth itself has strength, minerals, etc., etc. There's the power of growing things. So you plant a seed and it grows. Specifically, especially in Argentina, it's such a fertile soil, you can plant anything anywhere and it just grows. Whatever. So a person might think, I'm going to plant because the nature is that if I plant in this particular place, and of course I have to take care of it and put water, etc., etc., it's going to grow. It's going to grow. But that's the, so to speak, normal, regular frame of mind. What do I mean by normal and regular? A person that not necessarily believes in God. A person that has a strong feeling of faith in God, why does he plant? Because he believes in God. What does that mean? I mean, if you plant and if you don't believe and plant, it's going to grow anyway. Doesn't really matter whether you believe in God or not. But the idea is that when a person full of faith actually plants, he's not planting because the earth is giving strength to the seed and is growing a stalk of wheat or whatever you planted. No. It's because you believe that there's a godly strength behind it, and that's what's making the produce grow, which is exactly the same idea that I mentioned before. When a person lives his life in a way of looking around and saying, wait a second, whatever I'm seeing is a godly thing. The world transforms into something else. Usually, in ancient, so to speak, Jewish philosophy, and also in many other strands of philosophy, the philosopher usually tries to get out of the world, like separates himself, herself, whatever, from the world, because the world around you bothers you to concentrate, to understand godliness, to understand yourself, to understand the world, etc. It just go away. Like the priests in Nepal, they go to a mountain and they go, just forget it. Forget about the world. I don't need to talk to anybody. I'm just going into myself. And that's what they're actually doing. They're going just and connecting to themselves, not to God, to themselves, the way they understand things, which is, that's the problem with philosophy. It's just what the philosopher thinks. It's not really what, so to speak, God thinks. But the point is that in Judaism, we see things differently. We see things in a way, look, the world around you is not, quote unquote, against God. There's no such a thing as against God. Everything is godliness. The only question is, do you see godliness or you see the world? There's a story by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad Hasidism, that when he was in his deathbed, very few moments before passing away, he was talking to some of the people around him. I don't remember exactly who it was. And he told him, I don't see anymore the woods in the roof. I don't see any more wood. I'm just seeing the word of God creating the roof. Of course, we're talking about very lofty levels and very within tzaddikim, within righteous people. This was a very righteous person and near his deathbed, not before. So we're talking about the highest of the highest. But the point is that there's such a thing, there's an idea of not seeing the world as it is, seeing godliness in the world. Why is this an important thing? It's a fundamental thing to understand the world and your life. Why? Because you might see something around you that you don't really like it. And you might even see things on you that you don't really like them. But you know what? That's godliness also. Even if you don't like it. And that's something God is creating for you at that particular time, at that particular situation, place, etc., etc., for you to learn. The Baal Shem Tov, the founder of the Hasidic movement, used to say that from every single thing that a person sees, from every single thing that a person hears, has to learn something in his service to God. Even things that you don't really like, even things that you think are completely irrelevant. You know what? If you're seeing this, it's because it contains a teaching for you. And maybe somebody around you doesn't really see it, doesn't really pay attention to that. You know, they say, I don't really work on that, but whatever. There is such a thing as mindfulness. So people, to be more present in a specific time, in a specific place, to be more aware of things. So this is basically the same thing that I'm saying. When you're aware of things around you, the next step is not just be aware of things. Be aware that there's a God behind those things. And he's talking to you, and he's trying to tell you something. And maybe somebody around you is not aware of the same detail you are aware of. Of course, you can talk and say, you see the beautiful butterfly? Oh, I didn't see it before. Okay, the butterfly is going around in beautiful colors. Okay, maybe you saw it, the other one didn't see it. Of course, you can share. What I'm trying to say is, in a regular life, we see many, many, many things. So some things we pay attention to, some things we don't. But you should know that anything you see, you quote unquote happen to see, is because God put it there in front of you. It's not nature. It's not something that just happens. There's nothing that just happens. And just to end, so to speak, again, we just explained the order. I'm just going back a little bit quickly. We just explained the order of the prayer. Why? Because the beginning of the prayer, when it talks about salvation, miracles, and wonders, the beginning is talking about how the story went actually on. At the end of the prayer, when it talks about miracles, wonders, and salvation, it's talking about the perspective of a person, of a normal person. What would you be more thankful and praise God for? Miracles. First of all, miracles. Easier to praise. Because you see, God is here. Then wonders and then salvations. But the true, so to speak, teaching, the true teaching is, I have to include myself, we should learn to look around ourselves and be conscious that the truth is, every single thing is a miracle. It's not a salvation, it's not a wonder, it's a miracle. It's happening just for you, at a specific moment, at a specific place, etc., etc., specific circumstance, so to speak, for you to learn. And that in itself, so to speak, is a miracle. And again, just to end, I just put this phrase over here, the lowest is connected to the highest. This is a classical, mystical concept that where do you actually see the deepest and the highest things in life, in your job, in your spouse, whatever, in the deepest things, it's actually in the lowest thing and the smallest things. Very simple example, even though there are many, many ideas behind this, but very simple example. How do you express love, so to speak, to your wife? I speak like this because I'm a man and I have a wife, of course. Where do you see love? When you buy one flower, out of the blue, out of the nothing, because I wanted to buy a flower. You don't need to buy 2,000 flowers and flood the house. I love you so much. You just remembered me. That's it. One flower. It's enough. Because you remembered me. That's the whole thing. So in the most simple things, you see the deepest things. And the same thing happens in life, in this godly, so to speak, constant miracle. In the smallest things of life, you can find the deepest expressions of God. The smallest things of life, that you don't need to go to the mountains, you don't need to, whatever, to learn the whole books, all the books of Kabbalah and all the books, to understand something and to feel, no. In the most simple things of life. And to be honest, this is one of the reasons, like a deep reason, not necessarily a simple idea, but a deep reason why in Judaism, the main thing is action. Like you could feel very lofty levels of love for God and fear for God, but you don't do like action, it's worthless. On the other hand, if you do, even if you don't feel, has a value because you did it. You've changed the world in a physical way around you. You're right. It's much better, definitely, to do and feel. Oh, yeah, that's a very high level. Very nice. But sometimes it's difficult. And you know, human beings, we vary with time, how you woke up today, you know, like everybody else. So not necessarily you always feel the same, and you always feel the same strength and will and enthusiasm. Yeah, sometimes yes, sometimes no. Okay, but you should know that does not take from action, from doing. Why? Because of what I explained before. In the deepest and the deepest levels of godliness, you can find them in the most simple and physical, so to speak, actions. That's where you find God. That's where you actually connect to Him, so to speak. Okay. I hope you liked it. I hope it was understandable. Just a second.